Hi.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Back at it. Another episode of Origins. Just published our episode with Atul, which I thought was great. And
I'm excited for this one because this is our Series A episode with a experienced Series A investor who can help us thread the needle between what's going on at the seed and further out in the market. So that's great. It'd be fun to talk to her.
Beth is OG New York. She's been in the ecosystem, I don't know, probably 20 years. I think she ran ops at Etsy back in the day. I think she was the first analyst or associate at Flatiron Partners.
And for those people that don't know,
was Fred Wilson's.
That was Fred Wilson's first fund before Union Square.
First fund, right, with Jerry Colano, who's now a well-known coach. And then she started and ran the venture business at WME, which is really interesting. And now she's a partner at Firstmark. She's been there for 6 years. They focus on Series A. They have a growth fund, but I think it's more like an opportunities fund in their existing portfolio. And she's great. So I think this will be very good perspective on what's actually happening at Series A and maybe parts of growth, which I don't think we've covered in the last few episodes.
We haven't, but people should send us feedback about what they want us to cover, and maybe we could do growth, get somebody who's actually writing growth checks.
Yeah. I think that'd be a good idea. I don't know how we're going to find that person, but we'll do our best to search. That person still exists. Does Tiger exist anymore?
That's so funny you said that. Yes. Yes, they do.
They still exist.
Yes. I mean, some people have left, which I think is why you're saying that. And they've had some markdowns from what I've heard. But that's, you know, the crossover investing can be tricky in a stock market.
Yeah. Imagine they're just going back to public market investing. Something like that.
Yeah. I would have to read the reports. But we'll find somebody. I bet we can find
somebody. Expecting you to give me some dirt. Okay, well, let's get going. Very excited about this.
All right, off we go.
Thank you, Beth, for joining us today. Very excited to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. This is going to be fun. We're going to record for like 45 minutes, deep dive into mainly Series A market today. Here with my lovely co-host, Beezer, as usual. Beth, I think a great place to start is just tell us about yourself.
Sure. So I am a partner at Firstmark. I've been here for about 5.5 years. Before this, I started a fund with William Morris Endeavor, the talent agency, and invested primarily in consumer-facing businesses. And before that, I was an operator for over a decade. So, led operations at Etsy and again at another company called Fab.com. So, you know, deep marketplace experience from, you know, on the ground. And then started my career at a fund called Flatiron Partners here in New York.
Which some folks might remember as sort of the, what would you call it, USV 1.0?
Yeah, you know, it was really the first you know, fund dedicated to focusing on the internet when that was seemed like a very crazy and unusual thing to do. And then, you know, obviously since then there's a lot of companies or a lot of firms focused on it, but that was definitely the 1.0.
Yep. Internet turned out to be pretty big, I guess.
Yeah, it turned out to be pretty big.
And that was you, Fred Wilson, and Jerry Colonna, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That three. What was that like working at that period of time?
It was amazing. I mean, look, like, you know, I was
late 90s?
Yeah, late 90s. So I joined in 98. And you know, left in 2002. So I was there for the dot-com boom and, you know, all of the companies that we saw during that period, including when people were afraid to put credit cards on the internet and, you know, all those kinds of things. And then obviously post the crash 2000 and, you know, what that looks like on the other side. So tons and tons of learning from the standpoint of like, you know, where the innovation was going to come from and, you know, and then from the standpoint of, you know, what types of things in, you know, on the operations side worked and which ones didn't, because we spent a lot of time working out companies. So it was definitely a full breadth of experience as we, you know, spent time looking at that.
What's it like working at William Morris? The good and the bad. Give it to us.
You know, it was an incredible place. I mean, you know, I think the toughest part is creating a fund and creating legitimacy around the fund, because, you know, people look at, you know, what does the talent world understand about venture capital? But when you look at what their core business is exactly like venture capital. You're picking, you know, you're picking, you're nurturing, and they have and then when you talk about firms that have platforms, like their platform is, you know, unbelievable. I mean, it's the best in the world at what they do. And so, you know, as we were thinking about companies and thinking about what the value add of what William Morris Endeavor could do for these companies, I mean, the breadth and depth was so big, you know, so deep. So it went well beyond talent, because you can't make talent do anything. There was just so many functional expertise, whether it was on the PR side or the events that they did or the, you know, specific teams around the business. There was just so much to add. So, you know, it's, they can be an incredible partner to early stage companies and obviously late stage companies as well, but.
You joined Firstmark 6 years ago. I'm curious what your experience has been there, particularly compared to your vast breadth of venture experience over the last 20 years or so. And I'm curious how maybe some of your lessons learned at a more traditional Series A firm like Firstmark and potentially how you've changed as an investor over the last 6 years.
Yeah. Well, you know, I knew my partners for a very long time before I joined. As you know, I've been around the New York ecosystem, and so I've been really fortunate to work with them and learn from, you know, everything they've done as well. You know, I'd say that some of the big learnings have been, sort of going back to the basics is, you know, I joined before it got like really crazy, and then so the market got crazy, and now we're sort of recorrecting right now. When you think about it, is, you know, you go deep in categories that you're excited about and you have, you know, theses and ideas around like what businesses are going to work. But at the end of the day, particularly at the stage that we invest in, it's really about the people and it's about the product founder fit. It's about their ability to have, you know, their ability to manage change, their resilience, like thinking through what they shouldn't do or stop doing versus leaning into and all of that. So when I think about the journey, it's sort of almost going back to the basics around like, who are these people that we're backing? And when you look at where the most successful businesses that we've invested in, you know, including myself, are the companies that we had a relationship with the founder, we knew how they're going to work. So whether we had backed them before, or we knew them from, you know, our previous lives or whatever, like those are the ones where we have an outsized understanding of the business. And I think, you know, the other piece is, you know, having this period of COVID in between is that real understanding of the founder motivation was actually a little bit more difficult to get behind, because the relation, you know, you could still build the relationship. The relationship took more time because you didn't have the benefit of having, you know, a dinner or coffee or sitting in their office and sort of feeling and seeing how they interact with people. And so, you know, looking on the other side and looking at some of the investments that we did during that period, I think, you know, there's been lots of great investments made, but that's been that relationship piece and that understanding has taken a little bit longer.
Can you also tell us a bit more, Beth, what you specifically are looking at and what stage?
Yeah, so we invest seed in Series A. We're particularly, you know, it's interesting that, you know, all of the data says that, you know, there's fewer Series A's happening right now. We're very focused on Series A. We, you know, ideally, if we all the deals that we did this year you know, were Series A, that would be fantastic. You know, I think, you know, for me, what I'm specifically looking for is I have been spending a lot of time in the commerce stack. So think supply chain, commerce infrastructure, and sort of anything that, you know, I would have been either a builder or a buyer of in my operations roles. And so, and, you know, the nice thing post COVID is that there was all these problems before COVID, but there's so much light shed on so many of these issues that you know, one, there's more interest in these businesses just from a sales perspective, like companies are ready to buy. And then the second piece is I think we're going to see a whole set of new entrepreneurs coming in with like pushing the envelope with new ideas. So I'm actually really excited about the next, I'd say 6, 12, 18 months of some of these newer companies coming in. And so, you know, I wish we spent more time on pre-seed because I think there's going to be a lot, but, you know, hopefully it'll get to the place where, you know, we like to invest.
Well, okay. I'm super excited to dive in on this. Can I geek out a bit?
Hold on. I have one more question before we dive into Series A, and we have a lot of data, but my question for you, Beth, is you said it's all about the people, their resilience. And I agree, but I guess my question would be, I'm mostly a pre-seed investor. And if it's all about the people, why not just invest at pre-seed, rather than seed or pre-seed or seed rather than A?
It's a good question, right? I mean, usually we do some, right? And it's okay. Usually when we know the founder, right? So either we back them before or we have sort of an outsized view. So it does happen.
Yep.
But the core is, you know, our business model is we want to see some product, you know, at the seed and hopefully product market fit by the Series A and some traction. So, you know, we do span the, we do sometimes go rogue.
Yep. All right, Beezer, take it away.
Okay. I'm going to start out with my geek fest with the article that Nick sent to you and I before. And Nick, do you want to give people a little bit of data from that?
Yeah. And I'll share it in the show notes after, but we were talking about an article that Carta posted just recently about the private markets in Q1 of this year. And just some basic stats, total capital raised 80% down year over year. Down rounds up 3.6x. I think it was something like 20% of the rounds happening now are down rounds. Structure is coming back to the market, participating preferred. Beth, you can probably tell us more about what that looks like. Number of rounds happening way down. Valuations are actually seemingly starting to level off, and the valuation decline is more extreme at Series C, D, and then gets less so earlier stage, which is makes sense, and we can talk a little bit about that. But and particularly at the later stages, like Series C and D, basically like no investments happening. I think there were like 10 Series Ds or something in the first quarter. So market, I don't know how you would summarize that, Beezer and Beth, but like to me, sort of market's fallen off a cliff. And the question is kind of where we level out, what that looks like.
Yeah, and the part that I'm confused on, and I was sharing this beforehand, I've been to a couple annual meetings in the last week or two. It's sort of the spring season is back on. And there's a lot of discussion around how the quote is, no one knows how to price the A. And I presume that's because it's unclear with the B, C, and D. But I guess the part that's confusing to me is why? Because experienced investors know how to price a company. And there should be a raft of seed companies that now need to raise because we're coming into the second half of the year and all of last year. And the first half of this year, we heard about all of this groundswell of all these companies that are going to need to raise. So is it... help me unpack it, Beth, because I feel like it should be more obvious to me what the answer is, and I'm still a bit confused.
And you'd also think, just one last thing, you'd think it would trickle down all the way to seed, right? Like to where we sit, but seeds still seem like they're happening and chugging along.
Yeah.
And yet, although, like, if A's aren't, you think that would affect seed. So yeah, it is sort of confusing.
Although historically, it always takes a little bit of time, right? Something hits the public markets, and then it's the later stage, and then it goes to earlier stage. So I think seed is coming, but it hasn't come yet.
Yeah.
How to unpack this? So I think the first thing is that when you think about what board members were telling their companies last year was, one, deep cuts, two, increase your capital. So a lot of bridge rounds happening, or, you know, opening last rounds, or, you know, things like that. And like, try to weather the storm. So you want to get as far away from this as possible. And so it's not surprising that the numbers are down for the first quarter. But, you know, Beazer, as you mentioned, is like, at some point, these companies are going to need to come out. And we're just starting to see that. And like, from the acceleration of companies that, you know, are good companies, but maybe their investor base has already given them a lifeline, or, you know, can't invest for whatever reason, or wants to test the market because they're internal and they know that this company probably needs to be repriced and they're not the ones to do it. And so, or it's very hard for them to do it sitting on the cap table already. So, I'd say, you know, the first couple months of the year, it was much slower. I'd say there's been a lot fewer companies that you're excited to dig in. And now as we're coming into, April, May, there's definitely more companies in the pipeline. So, you know, so it's feeling better. So that's number one. I think the two is, venture investors are optimists. So, you know, it's always up and to the right, and they're super excited. And so when you get a company that has either, you know, been priced a little bit far over their skis, or, you know, just like something that needs to be adjusted, even if the core business is great, most venture investors are not super comfortable with that. And so you're seeing people punt on, like, I don't want to reprice this. And so, or on the extreme side is, this is what I do, and I'm going to go and like really be punitive on this kind of company. So, you know, sort of seeing like the barbell on that, which is also not fair to the companies either. So there needs to be something that feels like, to your point, Beazer, is like, well, we knew how to price these businesses 3 years ago. It's sort of the same fundamentals of what we would price them today. I think it's that delta, that sort of uncomfortableness in the market of like, okay, you know, how do we feel about that? And those are hard. Those are hard, hard conversations to have with founders, because, you know, you have, you know, most founders have in their head sort of the number of which they're, you know, valued at, and then cutting that in some cases in half is a really hard pill to swallow.
So for an example, just to bring it home in my head, let's say somebody had their seed round done at 15, and maybe the company wasn't really quite ready for that. And so they think it should be 30, or I'm making these numbers up, 45 in the A, and you're like, maybe it'll be 17 or 20. And it's having that conversation around that's where the sticking point is.
Yeah. And I think as time has gone on and you start to see the numbers, you're like, well, there's been, you know, 20% down rounds and X flat rounds. People are more open to those conversations. You know, you hear like flat was a new up, you know, type of things. So I think it's easier to have those conversations today than they were in, you know, November, December last year. So if you were in an unfortunate place, you know, in that period, it just, you know, harder to have that conversation. But the big thing that I'm actually surprised about is that there's not more companies shutting down.
Hmm.
And so I don't know if they're happening more quietly. Because, you know, look, like the graduation rate from C to Series A, it was an all-time high, you know, over the last couple of years. That's just not now. You know, there's companies that are just not going to make it. Like, that's just the way it is. And so you have a bunch of companies that are sitting at the Series A that are probably struggling, but we're not hearing about that. Hmm. So that's the one stat on that list that I was surprised by.
Part of the discussion in annual meetings is exactly this, which is expect more losses going forward. And sometimes in annual meetings, people will put out, you know, they'll show sort of three wedges. Like, here's the folks that we have really high conviction in, their business is doing whatever metric, that's great. Here's the ones that's too soon to tell, or there's something going on in the markets which makes it hard to see. And here's ones that have some questions, but we have yet to see. And here's the actual shutting down, small acqui-hire or whatever. And I'm assuming people are waiting, and this is going to be a back half of the year exercise because the dialogue is starting. I started hearing about it mostly in March, which was the first time.
The first time you're hearing it. Yeah, interesting. You know, a lot of these companies are kind of resetting. And so you have, you know, companies that had such a huge valuation at like, you know, the C or the D, you know, do their valuations get cut in half? You know, is it a complete reset? Like, it's probably not because the business is not fundamentally strong. It's because whatever, you know, they were such an exciting business that the market sort of got carried away on the, you know, on the valuation front.
Yes, like in generative AI today.
I have two questions for you, Beth. One is, and there's a bunch of founders that listen to this show that are maybe at seed. Like, what are the dynamics of a great Series A that you look at today? Maybe it's team, market, traction. Curious to hear your thoughts. And then I do want to talk about some of the growth stuff in a bit as well.
Yeah. So some of the characteristics, one, you know, obviously like big growing market, or, you know, is there an opportunity for them to create a market? So by the Series A, I think there should be a pretty strong story around, you know, if you're creating a market, what that looks like. You know, I think this is where the valuation issue kind of came into play. You know, historically it's been about $1 million in ARR revenue coming into the Series A. You know, in 2021, it was like approaching, right? And so if you're at 700, that's very different than at your 1.2, you know, at 1.2. And now the expectation is that you're hitting that and hopefully blowing past that. And so, you know, I don't think the goalposts have moved. They're just returning back to where they have historically been. Three is you're starting to build out the team. Like, you're starting to have, like, there's obviously going to be some holes, but you have some strong players around the table. So, you know, hopefully the founder, hopefully, you know, a CTO, and then there may be some, you know, about to hire a salesperson or deep marketing or, you know, something, but like eye to who those people might be or when you want to hire them is probably the third.
Should we talk about growth stage? Because Firstmark, I believe, also has a growth fund or opportunity fund. Are you doing growth rounds? Are you doing down rounds? Are you doing down rounds with some structure like we talked about? Are you seeing those rounds? I'm curious like how you play there.
So our opportunity fund is mostly earmarked for our existing companies. So we are very focused on what are the best opportunities and where should we be doubling down. And so that's how we think about, you know, we've always thought about our opportunity fund. And we do, you know, we do some very selective new names out of it. And, you know, in that, you know, the most recent deals are deals that we're already in. So, you know, taking our asymmetric information and making the best decisions with the capital we have.
And are you doing? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and those haven't been down rounds. Those have been like true growth rounds or internal to shore up the balance sheet type of deals.
I was just going to double click on what Nick was saying about the activity, and we. That Sapphire Growth Fund, we're also seeing activity, but it's definitely muted compared to what it was like during 2020, 2021. Does it feel like the companies that are graduating up to growth, the metrics are solidifying? And is it just the pricing of it that's the challenge? Or is it in this market, in the real market, like the outside world, like the real market, where there is some recessionary trends and there are budgets being compressed and I don't know about the consumer shopping levels, but you do see the enterprise cycles being taking longer to sell. Like, is that also affecting the companies that you're looking at?
Yeah, we're definitely seeing slow sales quarters. Issues obviously affecting these later stage companies have more capital. Their businesses are more developed. It's easier. It's, I shouldn't say easier. They have more levers to pull on extending their capital. So I think that's probably the biggest reason why we haven't been seeing a lot, because, you know, whether at whatever valuation that they're sitting at, all in almost every category, the comps are not even close to what they were when they raised capital in the past. So even if they're hitting all their numbers and growing, there's going to be a lot of compression on those valuations. So they're trying to push those rounds out. When I think about this is we don't know if the fourth quarter is going to be a better quarter than it is right now. You know, I would bet that it's going to be worse. And so, you know, thinking about the timing of that cap, like raising capital, if you need capital in the next year, is a very tricky conversation to have.
When do you think about structure in these rounds? Like, when have you seen it? Is it something that you think about? When does it make sense, maybe even for the company? Because I'm seeing, even at my, you know, even at our early stage, I'm starting to see like pay to plays, and, you know, we can talk about what these things are, but some things that are highly dilutive to and sort of painful for early stage investors.
Especially if you don't have the dry powder to protect your ownership.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think this is also goes back to people not wanting to price, right? Because if I'm sitting here and the company needs capital and I have to make a hard decision about what the structure of the round needs to look like, I'm likely going to be in it, and it's a down round or a significant down round, I'm probably in a position where a pay to play makes sense in order to catalyze more dollars around the table, but it's also a place where I don't necessarily want to be to basically dilute, you know, really early investors that have been with the company for a long time. So I think that's a hard, so I think people don't want to generally, I don't want to do that. Let's just generally, but look at what it takes to get these rounds done. In some cases, that's what needs to happen. Especially if you need to get, you need to get sort of enough dollars around the table. Then also sometimes the price needs to be in a place where you can attract external dollars in. And then thinking about, you know, all the dynamics around, you know, how much do you protect of your preference and all that, especially in a down round in a company that's raised a decent amount of capital that even might be more capital than the post-money valuation of the company. All of that stuff gets tricky. But generally, I mean, I think that's a mechanism in order to get capital into the business, yep, which is different than like, you know, a 2x, you know, liquidation preference or, you know, all of those kinds of things. And my view on that is, particularly in early stage companies, I'd rather just take the lumps. You know, instead of having sort of this optics of the valuation being flat, I'd rather just take the down round and, you know, everyone be on the same page. And just move forward. It's just cleaner. It's cleaner for later rounds. It's all that stuff. So, but founder, you know, people get very emotionally charged about the number. And so that's a way to make people feel better about it.
Kind of doing a 180. Do you think, I mean, just, we've been talking a lot about a lot of like defense, difficult conversations or funding's happening. I'm just curious, like internally in Firstmark, or maybe from you specifically, like, is this a good time to invest? Like, are these good deals? You know, that are lower valuations, potentially some good companies. Like, how do you guys think about offense and defense in this environment?
Yeah, I mean, look, we're really trying to be aggressive right now. We think it's a great opportunity. I think there's a lot of companies that, you know, for all of the reasons that we just discussed, you know, are good businesses, but, you know, for, you know, external reasons were priced incorrectly or whatever. And we're not afraid. I mean, you know, we have a very experienced team who's seen multiple downturns. I think pretty much all of us, you know, the entire partnership has. So we're not afraid of those. And we're actively looking. So I'd say, you know, when we, we're, we're looking, you know, we're also spending time thinking about, you know, we generally don't do Series Bs, but there's a lot of Bs right now that look like A's. And so, you know, those that's, you know, and have, you know, that many more months of operating history that, you know, we can kick the tires on to really understand what's working and not working in the business and get a better understanding of the risks that we're taking. You know, at prices that, you know, good companies are not going to be at fire sale prices, but like at prices that make sense from a return perspective and the risk reward that, you know, we're, or the risk that we're coming in at. So, they, you know, it feels much better.
Can I also ask a question? This was a conversation that came up at a meeting I was at the other day, and it was about, you know, back in the olden days when you financed a company, the expectation was not that somebody was going to be a multi-stack investor, but that you were going to be, that investors had to be around for a while because there may or may not be additional money coming in, right? The whole round happening every 6 months just wasn't a thing until SoftBank and then Tiger and everyone else got involved. And it feels like we're going back to that mentality a bit more. Can you unpack it a little bit at the Series A when you're funding a company now, what the expectation is for how long until the next round and how that thinking is going on? Because it feels like that's coming back, but maybe I'm wrong.
Are you asking about the timing between rounds?
If you're doing a new Series A investment now, how are you thinking about how the money will last and who's in the room and how that plays out?
Yeah, generally I think that we need at least 18 to 24 months, but we also look at, you know, the specific company and industry that they're in and what the metrics need to look like to raise that next round. And so having that conversation back and forth, because, you know, a lot of times founders are like, well, you know, we have these strategic initiatives and we want to get to X, Y, and Z. And they might not be thinking as strategically about like, well, what I'm doing is I'm mitigating the risk, the capital raising risk in this business. How can we think about getting to these metrics in the most time efficient way? And like, and how much capital do you need to do that? And so you want, like, the worst case scenario is being undercapitalized to do that. So, but generally, I mean, like, we saw rounds in 21 that like, oh, we'll do it for a year and we'll go back out. I think, you know, founders are getting the message that 24 is probably the right message or the right amount to be raising.
How about collaborating with other firms? Because historically also, like, one way to share the risk as an investor or give the company more runway is to share the investment with another firm. And I realize now the funds and the firms are so big now that maybe there's enough capital not to do that. But like at our stage, pre-seed and seed, I'm actually much more open to a co-lead now than I maybe was a year or two ago, especially if it's someone I really like and think can be helpful to the company. And we share the risk a little bit. And if there needs to be a little more capital raised, we can both do that together. And, so I'm seeing that kind of come back even at the earliest stages. Curious how you think about that, or if maybe that's irrelevant because FirstMark's funds are so big and, you know.
No, it's an important question, right? Because you don't want to be the only one holding the bag if, you know, you need to have some interim financings. But it's tricky because, you know, companies are generally wired to sell a certain percentage of their company. And we're wired, as you know, we think about our math, like the percentage that we need, you know, coming in at the Series A. And so that's the tricky part. So we do think very closely around, you know, who are the partners that could own a lesser amount that we've worked with in the past that have been strong partners and things like that. And, you know, when we think about our syndicates, we're very much thinking about that, but it's a little bit harder when you're trying to get to 15 to 20% ownership to have, you know, another larger firm in some of these deals. The seed, it's a little easier for us because, you know, we have an opportunity to buy up at the A, but it's harder for us to buy up at the B.
Yep.
Can I ask a question about the boardroom? I'm trying to visualize it because it sounds like a lot of these conversations for financing and things kind of happen in that, and like how a company is going to weather the storm. And like, you, like, generally speaking, don't take board seeds. I mean, most of the pre-seed seed funds we talk to, generally speaking, don't. I'm generalizing, but just to make my life simple. So Beth, when you show up, is it you and the founder and then like, yay, that's the board? I mean, how does that work? And then how do these conversations play out if it's that small a subset, right?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. I only have one company that's like that. The rest have at least another investor and sometimes two, because a lot of pre-seed and seed investors have gotten board seats. Or in the room have observer seats. So, you know, there's usually at least five, or my companies are later stage and have, you know, Series B investors and Series C investors around the table. I think this is where the concept of fiduciary duty is really important. And so, and separating your hat as an investor versus your hat as the board member and the steward of the decisions or strategic decisions of the company. And then sometimes it's a hard thing to do. So I think part of the reason that companies have not gone out is because there's this fear of markdowns from some investors around the table. And so they've been, or they haven't seen it before. So if you look at, there's many partners who've been partners for 10 years who've never seen a down cycle and don't know how to navigate that. And so, you know, those are the two big things I think have been some of the tougher conversations, because you might get the founder of like, okay, I get this and this is the reality and this is what I need to do. But then you have to get everyone else around the table on board with that's the direction in which we need to go. And that's been, and I'd say it's mostly in the situations where people who have just not have had the opportunity to experience it before.
You're not the first person to mention this. If you were to, because it's hard, 10 years is not an insignificant number of years. We do.
Yeah. I mean, like they're experienced.
One time, right. So of the percentage, and generally speaking, of the people you work with, like investing and co-investing in syndicates, can you generalize, and Nick, maybe the same thing for you, how many people actually have been through different down rounds? Because it presumes people have been around for longer. This is my third because I'm old. But
yeah, me too.
But that presumes some time on the ground, or Nick, who started in kindergarten.
Well, I think that's a really interesting point. I mean, I've been through a downturn professionally, but not as a venture investor.
Yeah.
So I do not have the experience in a boardroom seeing down rounds as a VC. But I have been through through the financial crisis, et cetera, which is its own insanity. I'm curious, like Beth, for you, like how much of your time is now spent managing the board? As someone that's seen this alongside the founder and what that looks like, and or not. Like I could also imagine a lot of youngish investors that have maybe been a VC for 10 years that haven't seen this, that think they know what the hell they're doing. And so, yeah, curious how you manage those dynamics. And I don't know if you can maybe give us like vague example without naming names or example or companies.
Yeah. I would say, as someone who's gone through a few of these, the biggest urgency that I felt over the last year was cutting to get the unit economics in a better place. And that conversation was a super hard conversation to have in almost every single boardroom that I was in. You know, obviously there's resistance because like, how are we going to build any of this stuff if we don't have people and, you know, all that. And then, you know, whereas I feel like the urgency wasn't necessarily there from some of my fellow board members, because, you know, and I've also been in a company that has run out of money. So I've experienced it firsthand. So, you know, it happens really quickly and every single month of cuts. So, you know, those two heads could mean 2 weeks of extra runway at the end while you're negotiating an exit, or, you know, it's like all of these things like matter, and, you know, negotiating out of certain contracts like matter. And so, it was a, and I think we're on the other side of it for the most part now, but it was a very tricky thing to navigate. Cause like I was feeling the urgency of like, this is right. exactly what we need to do. And I have to bring everyone around. So this is when you're going back to who the founder is, the relationships that you're building, and being able to get everyone on the same page. And it starts with the founder, because the founder needs to internalize that this is something that they need to do. And you also have to be the person when, you know, I had in one case, not to pick on pre-seed investors, but there, you know, it was like, you know, we can't do any of this stuff. You're going to go out and raise a giant round when there was no chance for them to raise that round. And that's a story that's much more fun and much more exciting to listen to, even though that wasn't necessarily the reality that they were facing at that moment in time. And so, you know, this is, you know, it's a long-term tough business, right? And so, you know, getting everyone, and it's interesting now that we're on the other side, and some of those conversations were not always fun and some tension filled, you see where people feel where they are now and feel like they're in a right. much better place, whether we've gotten capital into the company or, you know, we thought through what the fundamentals were and what the core team needed to look like and what it looks like now, and now feeling better that they had a partner to help navigate them through that. Because it's a, you know, especially if you're a first-time founder, even if you're an experienced first-time founder, I have a, you know, a founder in his late 40s that, you know, has never done this before, right? It's like, you need someone to help you think through like, yes, this is actually, like I went back and I was like, you got to negotiate out of your lease. Like, this is like, we got to figure this out. We can't be spending, you know, whatever for the next 2 years. And so some of those things are like, oh, I didn't even think about that. So getting into the nuts and bolts of all of that stuff. But that, I mean, I'd say that that's been the biggest challenge. I think going forward, most of those people have gone through at least one in their portfolio, like a hard conversation. Yep. So I think it's probably going to be easier going forward. But that initial sort of one, and what it felt like it was 180 in early last year, of like all of a sudden it was like, you gotta rethink your whole business. That was a hard shift for everyone.
Do you also think, given your experience in the past and then the market today, that folks like, I'm going to pick on you, Nick, because I know you'll forgive me.
Pick on me. I'm used to it. Peter and I have worked together for eight years now, so I'm used to it. It's okay.
Well, for a lot of pre-seed and seed investors, like I said, don't take board seats. And there's a myriad of other ways of staying in touch. So it's not that it's not communicating, right? At least that's my experience of what Nick and other people tell me. But do you think, given the dialogues that are happening and the decisions that have to be made, is there a disadvantage for not being in the room or not? I just was sort of curious, because it's a question in my head and people ask me, and I'm not in the room. So it's very hard for me to know what advice to give.
Look, I believe that there's a lot of ways to influence companies and stay close to companies. And if the founder feels like you're adding value to them, they're going to listen to you. You know, we have a model where we take board seats, and that's super important to us. A lot of those ultimate decisions get made in that room. And I think that's where like the influence and, you know, the votes and, you know, all of that stuff matters. But I think that, you know, look, like, you know, in that case that I just mentioned, the pre-seed investor really had the founder's ear, and they, you know, and they invested before COVID, and, you know, they were able to really influence a lot, in some ways good ways, in some ways less good ways. But we, you know, we were able to manage through it all.
And they were not on the board. Just in that example, they were not on the board, but yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Do you take?
Yeah, I was going to say two things. So I'm increasingly taking more observer seats.
Yep.
Partly to have some visibility into the board level conversations, partly to learn, actually.
Yep.
Like most of my board observer, and I'm on a couple boards as well. I've just learned a lot actually from growth investors and later stage investors. And that's been useful to me at the very early stages and thinking about what might happen with that company in the future. But the other thing I'd say is, this is sort of to your point, Beth, I get a lot of calls from founders either after the board meeting or before the board meeting, talking about the board meeting or doing a recap and working through some strategic items that they maybe got feedback from the board around. And those are also very interesting, special conversations to have, and in some ways even more honest and transparent than some of the conversations that are happening in the board.
Yeah. And you're helping them navigate what the feedback that they're getting.
Totally. Right?
It's like, why would your Series B investor be asking that question or pushing this?
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever it is, you're helping.
And like you said, a lot of the feedback is often divergent. So one board, you know, one board member thinks X, another board member thinks Y. How do I work through that? What's the right decision? You know, who's maybe right or wrong. And so it's nice, you know, it's not, I'm not making those decisions or have votes, but I'm another sounding board.
You know, and that's actually a very, very good point. And, you know, as when I was an operator, I'd been in these rooms where you had a bunch of divergent feedback or suggestions that may or may not have made sense for the business. And so you have to work through those. But I think the piece is, you have, you know, some founders are like, well, my board said I did this and I have to go do this. And that the founder or CEO needs to really understand that the responsibility to make those decisions are theirs. Like, they get the feedback, right? But they have to own those decisions. And it's not like, well, you know, on March 17th, we had this board meeting and we all agreed that we're going to do X, Y, and Z. So when this doesn't work, I'm going to go back to you and say, you know, this was a, you know, a group decision. It's still, you know, the ownership is still on the founder's seat.
I have one last question, maybe Beezer, you have one as well, which is, when what are the things that you're looking for in the market to perhaps begin to advise founders to start being a little more aggressive? Or maybe it's company specific, but we've talked a lot about over the last year, let's, you know, cut headcount, let's think about costs, let's focus on unit economics. What are the things that maybe in the market or company specific where you're like, maybe we should actually be investing more than we were?
Yeah, well, we have a case that we're
We
have a case that we're investing more, and the company is actually being fairly aggressive. So they have a product that's really working. They sell into large companies where the sales cycles are, you know, 10 or 12 months. They started to see some of those sales cycles contract. They also saw an opportunity to expand their product to other verticals. and so it's like a moment where the sales flywheel is really working, and they have like a bunch of really interesting partnerships that are going to continue to accelerate that. And then on top of it, it's like, well, you know, if we invest a bit in the team, we can actually be in like two other verticals in the next, you know, 12 to 18 months. It feels like a moment where, you know, and I think we're all trying to come around it and right. put more capital into the business. But there's no shortage of people who are interested in, and they just raised, in December. And so thinking about either, well, you know, do you open up that round or, you know, have, you know, some sort of step up, you know, to put another 10 or 20 million into the business makes a ton of sense. So I think that that's happening. And I think that's generally happening with existing investors. So you're not seeing those go out to market, you know, not seeing those go out to market.
Yep. So in other words, like very company idiosyncratic, but there are still pockets of offense and
yeah, growth. I think there's, you know, there's a couple buckets. You have the companies that are doing quite well, and, you know, we have companies that are still raising and, you know, jaw-dropping dollar valuations. And then you have some that are like, okay, well, there's a lot here that's great, but it's not, you know, it's not accelerating growth. You know, there's still some things that need to be figured out. You're going to need time. And, you know, how do you get that time? You you sort of think about the levers of, you know, growth versus investing on those.
Yep. Beezer, take us home.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm so excited to hear that you're doing Series A's, because we get all this noise in the market about how everyone's just doing seed because there's folks like Nick who specialize in pre-seed and seed and have always been doing it. And then there are, rumor has it, we'll see in the numbers, all these much larger, you know, multi-stage funds that are just doing seed because nobody wants to price the A or the B. And it's this, but we can still play, but we'll play this way. And so you can comment on whether or not you're the only person out there doing Series A's. But I was just very excited to have you on and to talk about this because Series A is an exciting part of the market. And it felt odd to me that everyone was running away from it instead of
leaving. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, from a competitive standpoint, I hope they're all running away from it. So we
can't like they're all going to get
it. Beezer, you have probably better visibility than either of us here. Is that actually true? Like, you see it in your underlying managers. Are people not doing
so
is Beth the only one?
We focus on early stage funds. So when they're talking about, I'm going to make up names, like Tiger are coming in and doing seed, apparently they are. We're not that's not a fund that we are going to be an LP in. It's just billions and billions of, it's just too big for a fund cycle for how we're focusing on early stage. That's just not our core. So we don't get to see their numbers behind the scene. But I can say consistently in every annual meeting we've been going to with our pre-seed and seed funds, they talk about how much larger funds are playing at seed and not doing the Series A's, even though that's really the bread and bucket. And this is what my question on the why people can't price the A, not to sound judgmental, like, oh, I suppose it did, which is people that have raised, you know, hundreds of millions or $1 billion Series A fund, they know how to price an A. It could just be to your point that they don't want to.
Yeah.
But that's what the vehicle is made for. It's not made for small C checks, right?
Yep. Yep.
But maybe you're the only one out there, and that's
this is a stern. This is a stern talking to from Beezer. Go do your job.
Go do your job.
Series A.
Geek out on portfolio construction, and it's just, you know, like that check either actually really has to act like an A and take 15% to 20% ownership and a different value. It sort of plays the A role, but just given the fund size and what people are trying to accomplish, it just feels like an odd. And given the number of seed companies that must be coming back to market, it just feels like an odd intermix of when will this behavior change?
When do we think it's going to change? Beth, last prediction. When do we think the market comes back?
I think it's 2024.
Yeah.
Really? I think it's going to get worse before it gets better. And, you know, I'd say maybe second quarter 2024.
Jerome Powell said that banks are stable, though. Don't worry. Nothing to worry about here.
Nothing to worry about there.
Why do you think Q2 next year?
I think we're still, you know, in our asset class, I think we haven't even scratched the surface of working through all the problems. And I think it's just going to take time.
Yeah. Cool.
There's going to be external to us that's just going to catalyze it. I mean, I can't think of anything that would catalyze a big shift. But I do think there are going to be more deals happening. I mean, there's a lot of capital. There's a lot of companies out there. There's a lot of great companies. So I think there's going to be more deals happening. But, you know, I think it's going to be under the same lens as what we've been discussing in this call.
And your comment about coming back later, that's a comment on the venture capital market being sort of in a place to do it, or is this also in conjunction with the macro and where we think?
Yeah, I mean, I think the venture capital needs to work. There's a lot of things that need to work itself out, right? and then on the macro piece, there's nothing. I mean, there's only negative indicators versus positive, right? So there's nothing that's going to be like, oh, this is going to be a catalyst to investment or a catalyst to thinking about valuations or, you know, companies, you know, sectors, you know, like enterprise SaaS or healthcare, or whatever that, you know, are really compressed right now are all of a sudden going to bleed. I don't see that.
All right. Well, very much looking forward to 2024. Let's get this year out of the way. Only another 7 months to go. And thank you so much for doing this with us, Beth.
No, thanks for having me. It was nice to see you.
This was really fun. Thank you. Bye.